Holiday Group by E. M. Delafield. Read by Helen Clapp. The Reverend Herbert Cliff Hayes' legacy had been paid at last. It seemed almost incredible. They had waited for it so long, talked about it so much, and alas, borrowed money upon it twice already. It reached them, indeed, in a terribly diminished form, what with death duties and mysterious stamps, and fees of which they had had no previous cognizance. The Reverend Herbert paid back all the borrowed money, and paid the premium on little Martin's educational annuity policy a whole month before it was actually due, and took out a brand new educational annuity policy for little Theodore, who had reached the age of 19 months without his parents having been able to afford this so necessary outlay on his behalf. Their second child, Constance, being a girl, Herbert had not thought it necessary to do more than open a post office savings account for her. Constance, as a matter of fact, would have been his favourite child, if he had considered it right to have a favourite child, which he didn't. But with boys, one had to think about education. The legacy paid their debts, enabled him to put a tiny nest egg into the bank, and caused Herbert to make an announcement to his wife. "Naturally," said the Reverend Herbert, frowning. He told her his plan. He had kept £20 out of the legacy in cash in his desk. It was there at this very moment, and it was all spent on a holiday at the sea. Herbert's living was a country one, and so they hadn't felt justified in going away every summer. It was, in fact, 3 years since they had been away. "Before Theodore was born," said Julia reminiscently. Constance, aged 4, had never even seen the sea. "When did you think of going, darling? It's the end of June now. Shall we be able to get in anywhere?"
"Oh, yes, I think so," said the Reverend Herbert, brightly and firmly, meaning really that he hoped so. "Of course, we shouldn't care for one of the fashionable, expensive, crowded places, should we, dear?"
"No, but even
Cornwall now, or North Devon, and that wouldn't be too long a journey, which would mean less expense. We needn't feel bound to any one date. Smith will take duty for me any Sunday I like, and we can get away on Monday and stay till the following Saturday week."
"What about Ethel?"
Ethel was their general servant. It was very difficult for Mrs. Cliff Hay to find a servant, and still more difficult to keep one. Ethel had been with them 6 months, and Julia's great preoccupation in life, after the welfare of Herbert and the children, was how to make certain that Ethel would never leave.
"Ethel will look after the house, of course."
"Dear, she won't sleep here alone, I'm perfectly certain. You know what girls are."
Well, we can settle about Ethel later, surely," said the Reverend Herbert rather peevishly. "Here I am, full of a surprise plan which I hope will be a joy and a pleasure to you, and all you can talk about is the wretched Ethel."
It did indeed seem ungrateful, looked at in that way.
"I didn't really mean it like that," said Julia, although she had really meant it exactly like that. "Of course, it's a glorious idea, Herbert, and so kind of you to think of it at all. I'd love it, naturally."
"It would do you good, dear," said Herbert, mollified at once. "We'll cast off all responsibilities for once and simply enjoy ourselves. After all, we're still young," he added wistfully.
And Julia, in quick response to the wistfulness, answered at once, "Of course we are." She, as a matter of fact, was 35, and Herbert 8 years older, but she had a suspicion that they both looked more. Herbert, because he was getting fat, and she because her hair was turning grey so very quickly. It wouldn't have shown, though, if her hair had only been fair instead of dark brown. Julia wrote to various places about rooms, and found, as she had expected, that everything was full up already, until the middle of October.
"If one was on the spot," said Herbert, thoughtfully, "I think, dearest, the only thing would be, if you didn't very much mind, for you to go yourself to one of these places, say Bewley, which is the shortest journey, and go round the town and find a lodging, or one of the less expensive hotels or boarding houses. It will really save you time and trouble in endless writing in the long run, and you're sure to find something.
Julia was rather astonished. He had never suggested that she should go away anywhere by herself before, but it just showed how much his mind was set upon this plan of a holiday. Julia went to Bewley, a journey of about 2.5 hours by train. It was a nice, hot day, and the sea looked very blue, and there were people bathing and children playing on the sands and climbing over the rocks, and Julia thought of Martin and Constance and Theodore and made up her mind then and there that she wouldn't go home until she'd found rooms for them. The place was small, only one cinema, no Pierrots, no bathing machines, and only a very tiny pier. It couldn't really be full up. The station was in the middle of the little town, and she walked slowly up the parade, not looking much at the white, shining square houses with green shutters and striped sunblinds and gardens that lined the roads, because she knew that these would be the most expensive of all the lodgings. Anything not directly overlooking the blue, sparkling sea would be cheaper. She turned up a little side road called Prospect Road. The prospect, if taken literally, referred to a number of small grey stone villas, all exactly alike, duplicated in two long rows. Almost every window had a card in it, bearing the word Apartments. Julia tried the first one.
"Full up till the end of September," said the woman pleasantly.
The next one was full up till October. So were the third and the fourth and the fifth. The fifth doubted very much if there was anything to be had anywhere in Bewley so late in the day. Rooms were generally booked in the winter or the early spring, sometimes the year before, if people wanted to return to the same house. But Julia could try Mrs. Parker in York Terrace, the last house but one on the left as you went down. Julia said that she was much obliged and went to York Terrace. She had expected to have great difficulty in finding what she wanted and was neither surprised nor very much discouraged. With three children and not much money, it was never easy to get in anywhere. She passed a pink house with "Board Residence" placarded on the balcony on her way to York Terrace, and went in, just in case, and asked for the manageress. The manageress thought she might have rooms.
"When would it be for?"
"Any date in July or August," said Julia. "Two rooms, and a double bed and a single one in each, or else three single beds in one room, for the children."
"Oh," said the manageress, differently. "Oh, I'm sorry, but we don't really care about taking children. How old would they be?"
5 and 4... "And nearly 2," said Julia, conscious that these were, of all the ages, the most damning.
"I'm sorry," said the manageress firmly.
They wished one another a good morning and separated. York Terrace was on the top of a hill. It would be a terrific climb up from the sands, but it needn't take more than 15 minutes, even with the pram. "The last house but one on the left, as you went down." It was called, poetically, Eventide. It reminded Julia vaguely of some hymn which seemed suitable, perhaps a good omen, or was that being superstitious? "Mrs. Parker?"
"Yes?"
"I was wondering if you had any rooms vacant any time in July or August," glibly began Julia, in the formula that she had now used 7 times within an hour.
"Any time in July or August?" said Mrs. Parker.
"Any time."
"I've the middle of July practically vacant, owing to a party having failed. How long would you be wanting the rooms, and for how many?"
Julia gave particulars, not slurring the ages of the children. Her heart leapt when Mrs. Parker asked if she would care to see the rooms. One front bedroom, one back one on the same floor, the requisite number of beds, and a small sitting room downstairs. "What are your terms for these rooms?"
6 guineas a week after the first week in July. I have to try and make up, in the season, for all the rest of the year, when I may get no let at all," said Mrs. Parker mournfully.
6 guineas wasn't too bad, but Julia knew about landladies. "Does that include cooking and attendance?"
"Yes."
"Lighting, if any?"
"Lighting is an extra. It varies so much."
"Baths?"
"Baths are naturally an expense. 6 pence a hot bath is."
"And what about early morning tea?" said Mrs. Cliff Hay, having learnt all the moves in the game by painful experience 3.5 years ago at Ilfracombe.
She could see that Mrs. Parker, while resenting this catechism, at the same time respected her for it. She replied curtly, but not unkindly, that early morning tea would be sixpence, without bread and butter. "Just the two cups," said Mrs. Parker. Julia engaged the rooms. "In time for tea on the 15th, said Mrs. Parker. "Shall I order in some bread and milk and butter? And what quantity of milk shall you be requiring? And will you want cake or jam for tea?" Julia gave the required information. "Plain or fancy?" Mrs. Parker further demanded, referring to the cakes for tea. It was evident that she had been keeping lodgings for years, Julia thought, and said, "Plain, please. Buns. Sixpenny ones would do. We shall be bringing the baby's pram."
"That'll be all right, at the back."
All being thus made clear between them, Julia Cliff-Hay promised to send a postcard confirming the time of their arrival and walked back to the station again. As there wasn't a train for an hour and a half, she had time to go slowly and to have a cup of tea on the way. Herbert, hearing of her success, was delighted and said twice in the course of the evening that it would be a second honeymoon. And although Julia, who had been young, ignorant and frightened at the time, had not enjoyed her honeymoon at all, she had long ago succeeded in forgetting this with her conscious mind, and now agreed with him quite happily, and looked forward eagerly to the holiday. The question of Ethel was settled about a week later, after a good deal of difficulty. She was to go home to her mother and take the Cliff Hayes cat with her, and the rectory was to be shut up, and the gardener would keep an eye on it. But Ethel's mother always puts some nonsense into her head, and goodness knows if we shall ever get her back, thought Julia. And if Ethel isn't here and the house is empty, we can't very well have in the sweep as I should have liked. It'll have to wait till we get back. When 12 o'clock on the 15th of July came, the packing was done. The suitcase and portmanteau belonging to Herbert and a small tin trunk containing the effects of Julia and the three children were locked and labelled. The basket with sandwiches and bananas in it stood ready. Ethel, with the protesting cat in a little hamper, waited at the back door. The village Ford that was to take them to the station was due in 20 minutes, and Herbert, Julia and their two elder children waited anxiously for the infant Theodore to wake from his morning sleep, so that the pram could be put into its sacking and get its label tied to the handle. "You know how it'll upset him if we do wake him. I'd wake him in a minute, if it didn't mean that he'll be so cross all the way down," said Julia, for about the seventh time. "That's all very well, dear, but I can't tie the covering onto the pram all in a minute, and we do not want to miss the train."
"Miss the train?" echoed Martin, aged 5, in great dismay. "Shall I have a spade, Daddy?" said little Constance.
"If you're good, dear. I can't think why he's sleeping so late this morning. It's always the way when one doesn't want them to." Julia made a hasty trip to the front door, outside which stood the pram. Theodore, inside it, still slept peacefully.
"Daddy, shall I have a spade?"
Constance said earnestly.
"Yes, darling."
"A real spade, Daddy?"
"Yes, yes, certainly, when we get there. I say, Julia, you must really wake this child. This is nonsense. I'd wake him in a minute, if it didn't mean that he'll be so cross all the way down. Oh, I can't think why he's sleeping like this. He never does, as a rule, but it's always the way."
Ethel appeared in the hall.
"The car is just coming up the lane, and didn't we ought to wake baby? He'll be so cross. Oh, there! Isn't he moving?" "Mummy!"
said Constance in a voice of passionate and uncontrollable anxiety.
"Can't I have a spade?"
"Certainly, my pet, you shall have a spade, I promise you. Oh, well, if that's the car, Ethel." Ethel darted towards the pram. Theodore was awakened and cried pitifully, and Julia hurried him into the house and changed all the clothes he had on for other similar clothes that were clean instead of dirty, and Herbert tied up the pram and helped the driver to put the luggage on the car.
"Martin, dear, run and tell Mother that we shall miss the train," said Herbert,
who had all his life suffered from train fever. Martin rushed in, shrieking,
"We shall miss the train! We shall miss the train!"
And Julia said, "Oh, no, darling," soothingly, and finished off baby as quickly as she could and ran out with him to the car.
"Can I sit in front?" said Martin. "No, me," said Constance.
"Daddy will sit in front."
"With me on his lap." "No, me."
"It's Martin's turn," said Julia, who had to remember these things. "Constance, darling, come and sit with Mother and Theodore in the back."
"Tell me a story, Mother," cried Constance.
Julia immediately said, "Once upon a time there was a little pig who lived in a wood, and wave goodbye to Ethel, darling. Baby wave his little hand. Ta-ta, Ethel. Are you all right, Herbert?"
"Quite, thank you, dear. Have you any room for your feet?"
"Yes, thank you. Lived in a wood and went out every day to look for acorns." The story lasted until they reached the station, when Julia said, "Get out carefully, my pet, and wait for Mother."
"Am I going to have a spade for the sands?"
"Yes, you shall all have spades." On these lines, the journey proceeded. Herbert was very kind and took his turn in amusing the fractious Theodore, and Julia told stories and reassured Constance about her spade, and from time to time smiled her pleasure at the holiday having really begun, and received Herbert's equally pleased and sympathetic smile in return. And it was a fine day, even if not a very warm one. Everything was ready for them at eventide, down to the 6 plain buns upon the tea table, and the moment tea was finished, they went out.
"To the shops, please, dear," Julia said. "I've got to order the things for our meals tomorrow. It's Sunday, you know, and she's got nothing in for us, except just the milk and the bread."
"And shall we get my spade now, Mother?"
said Constance, in a trustful, uncomplaining voice.
"Yes, of course. Poor little thing, you have been patient," cried Julia,
really believing this, owing to the fabulous number of times that she had heard her daughter's request.
"Will you let me have some money, Herbert?"
"I'll come with you," said the Reverend
Herbert, and he took Martin's hand.
"Is the pram undone, darling, because of baby? It's too early to put him to bed, and besides, I couldn't leave him alone in a strange room anyway. But we ought to hurry, because the shop shut at 6.
They unwrapped the pram and set out. Julia had a list, and they went, as fast as the pram, the narrow streets, the people, their unfamiliarity with the locality, and the short legs of Martin and Constance, would permit, from the butcher to the grocer, and the grocer to the greengrocer, and the greengrocer to the baker. Everything seemed to be a little more expensive than the same things would have been at home, but one expected that, on a holiday. When the shopping was done, and it included spades, buckets, and sand shoes for all the children, it was time for Julia to go back and put Theodore to bed. Herbert took the other two down to the sands. He was so good about the children, Julia reflected thankfully. Even at home, where he was busy, he often helped her with them on Ethel's afternoon out. Theodore was good and went to sleep quickly, and Julia had done nearly all the unpacking before Herbert and the elder children came back and she had to put Martin and Constance to bed. At 7:30, Mr. and Mrs. Cliff Hay had supper. Mrs. Parker had made it perfectly clear that when she said "no cooking" in the evenings, she included things like potatoes or even cocoa. But Julia had brought a spirit lamp and boiled water herself, which made them independent. After supper, Herbert wanted to go for a walk, and Julia, who didn't like leaving the children and was very tired besides, reluctantly went with him. She was but an abstracted companion, and Herbert, disappointed, was quite ready to come in again by 9 o'clock. By 10, Julia, who could scarcely keep her eyes open, having seen that Martin and Constance and Theodore were all sleeping, went to bed herself.
"You won't be quite so tired, I hope, at nights after a few days' holiday," said the Reverend Herbert, when he in his turn got into the double bed.
He tried to make his voice sound only kind and not resentful, but the effort was wasted upon Julia, who was sleeping like the dead. The days sped by only too quickly. The order of them was always the same. Between 6 and 6:30, Theodore woke and was taken into his parents' bed so that he might not disturb the other two children, who seldom opened their eyes till 7 o'clock. At 7:30, Mrs. Parker brought the early morning tea, without bread and butter, and Julia got up and washed and dressed and brushed the three children. At 8:30, they had breakfast. Then the sands, Julia doing the necessary shopping on the way. There was always something to be ordered or bought for the children. The weather wasn't too bad for an English July.
Julia thought it rather chilly, but then she had to adjust her pace to that of the baby, who could only toddle about or sit on the sand scooping holes with his fingers. While Theodore had his sleep in the pram, the others bathed. Julia, years ago, had liked swimming, and Herbert was very good at it. It brought home to her the fact that she was no longer very young, when she found herself secretly rather dreading the daily treat of the bathe. Perhaps it was the difference between being able to swim with Herbert and having to remain close to the edge of the water, encouraging Martin, who was inclined to be nervous, and calling out, "Yes, I see, darling," to Constance, who was under the impression that she was swimming if she stuck her fat arm straight out in front of her and kicked the water with her feet. Herbert, as usual, was goodness itself. He tried, although not successfully, to teach the two elder children to swim, and he squeezed out their wet bathing dresses while Julia hurriedly dried and dressed them in the bathing machine, and then he generally struck out to sea again, so as to give her time to dress herself before he sought the bathing machine. Still feeling damp and mottled, Julia would hasten out into the rather fitful sunshine and distribute buns to the children, and try to warm her slightly discoloured hands by rubbing them in the sand. At least she kept her hair dry, for it was no longer the sort of hair that one rather enjoyed wetting, for the sake of letting it dry in the open air afterwards. Her thoughts went back to other holiday times, which strangely enough seemed not at all remote, when she hadn't been mother but only Julia, and Mama had been mother, the omniscient, all-powerful and ever-present universal provider. Was it possible that Mama, who had been dead 10 years, had then felt exactly as Julia felt now? She could certainly remember a reluctance, at the time incomprehensible, on the part of Mama to join in delightful hill-climbing expeditions or early morning swims at Weymouth. Every year they had gone to Weymouth, Papa and Mama and Julia. One hadn't realised in those days that one was lucky to be taken to a nice hotel, where nobody bothered about extras, and there was a real meal at the end of the day as a matter of course, not just a slice of cold ham and bread and cheese and cocoa made over a spirit lamp. "Oh, what a pig I am to think about the food like that," thought Julia. "Though really it's on Herbert's account, except the cocoa, which is such a comfort when one's cold or tired. Had Papa and Mama really been well off?" Julia, who had inherited their small savings, knew that they hadn't, although, of course, the value of money had altered altogether since the war. It had just been that, in the past, she hadn't had the responsibility of any of it, hadn't known or cared how the holiday was paid for, how the plans were made, how the meals were ordered, or anything else. She had gone on being blissfully irresponsible until she was quite grown up. She could remember the last Weymouth holiday before Papa's death, when she had just left school, and she had wanted to go every night to the concert on the pier with a school friend who was staying with her. Papa had taken them, and Mama, to their incredulous astonishment, evening after evening, had declared that she preferred to go to bed. "But she was much older then than I am now," reflected Julia.
"Mother, look at me!" screamed Constance.
"I see, darling. Wonderful.
But did I turn head over heels?"
"Well, very nearly. Next time it'll be quite."
"Mother, may I have the last bun?"
"No, Martin, dear. It's really too near dinner time."
"Then will you help me to build a castle exactly like the one we made yesterday?"
Julia got up, feeling stiff.
"Did I nearly turn head over heels?"
"Very nearly." Herbert emerged from the bathing machine.
"Daddy, I turned head over heels."
"Nearly," Julia inserted automatically.
"I nearly turned head over heels."
"Did you, dear? Well, Julia, did you enjoy the water? Oh, you look cold, my dear. If you didn't stay in the shallow water so much, but went right out of your depth at once, you wouldn't feel cold."
"The walk up the hill will warm me." The steep ascent to York Terrace was not much liked by Martin and Constance with their short legs, and Julia always told them a story while they climbed. Herbert pushed the pram. After dinner, the two elder children were sent to rest for an hour on their beds, and Julia amused the baby downstairs, and Herbert read the paper. Then they all went on the sands again, or once or twice for an excursion by Charabanc, But the children were too young to enjoy these, and rendered the whole family unpopular with their fellow passengers, except, indeed, with those who had with them children of the same age. But Julia, unreasonably, didn't like being told that the little ones are all alike, and never let this opening lead to any further. Tea, the day fell naturally into the categorical division of time that separated one meal from another, was generally taken at their lodgings. The cafe in the High Street, where there was a small string band, was amusing, but it cost money, and little Theodore was really too young for that sort of place, and Constance, who was easily made bilious, was sure to eat something that would disagree with her later. Very soon after tea, Theodore was put to bed, and the other two children played in the sitting room, since it would be too much for them to walk down to the sea and back once more. Julia came downstairs, read about Little Black Sambo or the story of Peter Rabbit, and then took Constance and Martin upstairs. When she came down again, it was usually nearly 7 o'clock, and there was only time to do the mending that always seemed to be required on one garment or another. At 7:30, supper, that cold and skimpy meal that was disposed of in rather less than 20 minutes.
"How the time flies, doesn't it? I can't believe we've been here so long already. What about a little walk this evening?"
"Yes, only I don't much like leaving the children. If baby did happen to wake..."
"Surely, with two women in the house..."
"Dear, I can't possibly ask Mrs. Parker to go to him, and it wouldn't be any good if she did either."
"I suppose not. Well, you're not tired, are you, Julia?" "Did I yawn? Oh, it must be the air. It's much stronger than the air at home. It'll do us all good. The children look quite different."
"Yes, don't they?" she said eagerly, and then immediately yawned again.
"Julia!"
exclaimed the Reverend Herbert. The truth was, as they both knew too well, that Julia was intolerably sleepy. She was often sleepy at home, too, since she had never been without a baby in her room after the first year of her marriage, and was always awakened early in the mornings. But at home she sat at her desk in the evenings, or sometimes played the piano, and kept herself awake that way. At home, also, Herbert was busy, and took it for granted that she should go to bed before he did. But on a holiday, a second honeymoon, things should have been different. He was kind, as ever, but he evidently didn't understand it. Julia tried going to bed very early indeed, and getting some sleep before Herbert came up, on the understanding that he should wake her when she would then be fresh and lively and ready for conversation. But she wasn't fresh or lively, and indeed it proved to be almost impossible to wake her without the employment of real physical violence.
"And yet," said the Reverend Herbert rather reproachfully, "if one of the children so much as turns over in the night, you're awake directly."
Julia wondered, but did not like to ask, if that was perhaps the reason she was so sleepy now. She said feebly that she thought there was an instinct which woke mothers on behalf of their children.
"When we get home," she said, hopefully, "and I know that Martin and Constance are in their own nursery with Ethel next door, I shan't wake so early in the mornings, and then I shan't be so tired at night. Besides, it's this wonderful sea air.
It's doing wonders."
Julia's eyes grew fixed and watery. The muscles of her jaw became strangely set, and she tightly compressed her lips in the suppression of an enormous yawn.
"Go to bed, my dear,"
said her husband forbearingly. And she looked so miserable that he added, entirely to try and comfort her for her inadequacy, "It's the sea air." Right up to the very last day of their fortnight at eventide, the sea air continued to demonstrate its effects upon Julia. The final evening was marred by the usual discrepancy between the visitor's attitude towards their bill and that of the landlady.
"Of course I knew she'd stick it on in the end, as they always do," said Julia. "But really, when it comes to cruet, sixpence... And neither of us touches mustard or pepper, and I'm sure the poor children haven't eaten 6 pennyworth of salt the whole time they've been here."
"Absurd. But still, if that's the only extra..."
"The only extra?" cried Julia. "Why, the whole thing is extras. And she's put down that hideous glass vase that baby smashed in our room as valued at 3 and 8 pence.
"Shall I have her in?" said the Reverend Herbert, wearily. "It's no use letting that sort of person think that one doesn't know one's being robbed."
"No, of course it isn't." They both of them dreaded the interview with Mrs. Parker, and knew that they had no possible chance of getting the better of her. But they felt, confusedly and miserably, that in some mysterious way they owed it to their caste to show Mrs. Parker that her extortions were resented by them. Julia, in a deprecating, apologetic voice, called Mrs. Parker. An interview on lines exceedingly familiar to Mrs. Parker ensued. At the end of 37 minutes, the sum at the foot of Mrs. Parker's bill, reduced by half a crown, had been paid by the Reverend Herbert, and the bill duly receipted by the landlady.
"Thank you, sir," said Mrs. Parker, her voice suddenly pitched in a more natural key. "I'm sure I hope you've all enjoyed your stay."
"Very much indeed, thank you. It's done us all so much good."
"A thorough rest," said Herbert, not without a glance at Julia. "Perhaps we shall come again another year." "I hope so, sir, I'm sure. Good night, sir. Good night, ma'am."
"Good night, Mrs. Parker," they replied together, with amiable smiles. The door shut behind Mrs. Parker. "I suppose they're all alike," said Julia tolerantly. "After all, they've their living to get."
"It must be a dog's life. And extortionate though she's been, she's let us down pretty lightly over the damage the children did. I saw that ink stain on the counterpane myself.
And naughty little Constance's hole in the wall, over the bed.
It isn't everywhere where they'll take children at all."
"No, that's true. One might do a great deal worse than come here another year. I mean, supposing we're able to afford another holiday one year."
"Now that we've got this legacy, Julia dearest, and that our debts are all paid, I want to afford a holiday every year," said the Reverend Herbert, adding with unwanted effusiveness, for he was a reserved man, "you and I, and little Martin and Constance and the baby, and perhaps other little ones, if we should be blessed with them, to get right away from home cares and worries and responsibilities, and have a thorough rest and change. I value it on your account, even more than on my own."
Julia laid her thin hand upon his plump one, and her eyes, her tired eyes, filled with the easy tears of utter contentment. She thought, as she had often thought before, that she was a very fortunate woman. Her heart swelled with gratitude at the thought of her kind husband, her splendid children, and the wonderful holiday that they had all had together. You have been listening to Holiday Group by E.M. Delafield, a BBC Radio Drama Company production, read by Helen Clapp. The producer was Kieran Birmingham.